something could be done about them. Annie started to laugh.
What have I said now? Said Malcolm wearily.
Annie could hear her mother's voice in there somewhere. It was the tone she used when Annie had taken her to task for saying that the IRA killed people or that children needed their fathers. Actually, Annie could see now relatively unobjectionable banalities that in the exotic political climate of the early 80s had come to sound like incendiary fascist slogans.
Do you really think you're in the right job?
Why wouldn't I be?
Well, the reason I come to you at all is because I don't want to be quite content with my unhappy, boring, frustrating marriage. I want more. And you think I'm a bit of a crybaby. You'll probably end up thinking that anyone who sits in this chair is a bit of a crybaby, really.
Malcolm stared hard at the carpet, which was presumably where this conundrum had ended up somehow.
Well, he said, I'm not sure that's it.
So what is it, if it's not that?
You said you don't want to be quite content.
Yes, with a rubbish life.
She said it as if he were deaf, which of course he might as well have been. She became momentarily distracted while she tried to decide whether deafness might have played a part in the unsatisfactory nature of their sessions. When Malcolm didn't seem to hear what she was saying, was it because he wasn't able to?
The context is important.
But people who are quite content don't have a rubbish life, he said.
Annie opened her mouth, ready to fire off the dismissive one-liner that always came to her whenever Malcolm offered any kind of observation. But to her surprise, there was nothing there. Her mouth was empty. Could he be right? Did the contentment count more than the life? It was the first time she'd thought about anything Malcolm had ever said to her. She had never told Duncan that she went to talk about her problems on Saturday mornings. He was under the impression that she went to the gym or shopping. He wouldn't have been unhappy about it if he'd found out. He'd have worn it as a badge of honor, even though he hadn't been directly involved in the therapeutic battlefield. For him, it would have been yet another example of the kind of thing that separated them from, raised them above, the rest of Ghoulinus. So that was one reason she kept it a secret. The other was that she didn't really have any problems apart from Duncan. That he wouldn't have wanted to know, not at first. And then he would have wanted to know everything, and it would have been impossible. So she took her swimming things out with her, or came back with a second-hand book from the thrift shop, or a pair of cheap shoes, or a bag full of groceries, and Malcolm stayed a secret. When she left Malcolm's house up near the elementary school and started to walk back into town, she realized that she didn't need to buy anything to prove to Duncan that she hadn't been telling a complete stranger how much he disappointed her. It felt strange walking home empty-handed. Strange, a little risky, and yes, of course, a little sad. It was lies like those that reminded her that she had someone to go home to. But when she got back to her newly empty house, Duncan was sitting in it, waiting for her.
"I've made us some coffee," he said, "in a pot."
The pot was significant, otherwise he wouldn't have mentioned it. Duncan thought that real coffee was a bit of a fuss, what with all the waiting and the plunging, and claimed to be happy with instant. This morning's gesture was presumably intended as some kind of penance for his infidelity.
"Gee, thanks. Don't be like that."
"Why would I care what coffee you drink?"
"If I hadn't slept with someone else, you'd be pleased."
"If you hadn't slept with someone else, you'd be drinking instant." Duncan conceded the point by saying nothing and taking a sip from his mug.
"You're right, though. It's much nicer."
Annie wondered how many similar concessions Duncan would have to make before they'd have a relationship that might conceivably last them for the rest of their lives. 1,000? And after that, he could begin to work on the things that really bothered her. "Why are you here?"
"Well, I mean, I still live here, don't I?"
"You tell me."
"I don't think you can just tell someone whether you're living with them or not. It's more a consensual thing," said Duncan.
"Do you want to live here?"
I don't know. I've got myself into a bit of a mess, haven't I?
You have, yes. I should warn you, Duncan, I'm not going to fight for you. The whole point of you is that you're not the sort of person anyone fights over. You're my easy life option. The moment you stop being that, you're no option at all.
Right. Well, that's telling me straight, thank you.
Annie shrugged, and it was nothing gesture that capped what she felt had been a flawless couple of minutes.
Would you say there's any way back for me? If that's what I wanted?
Not when you phrase it like that, no. One thing was clear. The rest of Duncan's Friday night hadn't gone well. Annie was tempted to press him for details, but even in her anger she could recognize that the impulse was not a healthy one. It was easy to imagine, though, that this other woman would have been extremely disconcerted by Duncan's appearance on her doorstep, if that's where he'd gone. He'd never been equipped with a great deal of diplomacy, intuition, or charm, even when they'd first started seeing each other, and the little he did possess would have been eroded by 15 years of underuse. Clearly, this poor woman was lonely. It was almost impossible to arrive in Gulenus from somewhere else without leaving a trail of unhappiness and failure behind. But anyone desperate enough to usher Duncan straight into her life at 11 o'clock on a Friday night would be unemployable, possibly even under medical supervision. Annie's guess was that he'd spent a sleepless night on a couch.
So, what should I do?
It wasn't a rhetorical question. He was looking to Annie for some firm advice. You need to find somewhere to stay, preferably this morning, and after that, we'll just have to see.
But what about my...
You should have thought about that before.
I'll just go upstairs and...
You do what you have to do. I'll go out for a couple of hours. Later, she wondered how he would have finished the question. What about his what? If she'd been marched down to a bookmaker's at gunpoint and asked to place a bet on what it was Duncan felt he couldn't live without for a couple of days, she'd have put her money on Tucker Crow bootlegs. While Duncan was packing, she went to work. She told herself, literally with words muttered under her breath, that she had loads of email to catch up on. But even Malcolm might have deduced, given all the relevant information, that she wanted to see if she'd heard from Tucker. This was her workplace affair with a man on another continent that she'd never met and wasn't ever likely to meet. The museum didn't open until 2 on Saturdays, so there was nobody else around. She killed the first few minutes of the promised 2-hour absence by wandering around what was officially and grandly known as the Permanent Collection. It had been ages since she'd really looked at what they asked people to pay to see, and she wasn't as embarrassed as she thought she might be. Most museums in seaside towns had bathing machines, the peculiar Victorian beach huts on wheels that allowed ladies to go into the sea without exposing themselves to onlookers. But not everybody had a 19th-century Punch and Judy stall, complete with grotesque puppets. Gulenus, typically, was the last town in the UK to employ dippers and bathers. Dippers dunked ladies into the sea, and bathers immersed the gentlemen. And it was a calling that had mostly vanished by the 1850s. Gulenus, however, had been so far behind the times that the museum had late 19th-century photographic evidence of both teams. And to her surprise, she could now see that their photograph collection was really pretty good. She stopped before her favourite, a picture of a sandcastle competition that must have been held at the turn of the last century. There were very few children visible, one little girl in the foreground wearing a knee-length dress and a sun hat that might have been made out of newspaper, and the competition seemed to have drawn a crowd of thousands. Would Roz tell her that this, too, was the best day in some poor coal miner's life, the day he had a front-row view of the Gulenus sandcastle competition in 1908? But Annie's eye was always drawn to a woman over on the right, kneeling on the ground, working on a church steeple in what looked like a full-length overcoat and a peasant sun hat that made her seem as sad and as destitute as an old peasant in the Vietnam War. "You're dead now," Annie always thought when she saw her. "Do you wish you hadn't wasted your time doing that? Do you wish you'd thought, fuck the lot of them, and taken your coat off so you could have felt the sun on your back?" We're here for such a short amount of time. Why do we spend any of it building sandcastles?
She would waste the next 2 hours because she had to, and then she would never waste another second of however much time she had left to her. Unless somehow she ended up living with Duncan again, or doing this job for the rest of her working life, or watching EastEnders on a wet Sunday, or reading anything that wasn't King Lear, or painting her toenails, or taking more than a minute to choose something from a restaurant menu, or... It was hopeless life, really. It was set up all wrong.
Duncan wouldn't have believed it was possible to feel more miserable than he'd felt in the Indian restaurant telling Annie that he'd been unfaithful and then watching her walk out. But actually packing his suitcase was, if anything, slightly more uncomfortable. True, the infidelity conversation had involved the most excruciating eye contact he'd ever had to put himself through. It would be a while before he forgot the hurt and the anger he'd had to look at in Annie's eyes, and, if he hadn't known her better, he might have come to the conclusion that there'd been hatred there too, and possibly some contempt. But now, putting his clothes into a suitcase, he felt physically sick. This was his life, right here, and however many things he put into a bag, he couldn't take it with him. Even if he could take everything he owned, he'd still be leaving it behind. He'd spent the previous night with Gina, in Gina's bed. She hadn't, as far as he could tell, been surprised to see him. On the contrary, she talked as if she'd been expecting him somehow. Duncan had tried to explain that he would prefer to look on her as a friend with a sofa for the time being, but Gina didn't seem to understand the distinction, possibly because he hadn't explained that he was homeless, nor the circumstances surrounding his homelessness. "I don't know why you'd want to have sex with me one night and sleep on the sofa the next," she said. "Well, of course, they weren't consecutive nights," he said, and he could almost hear Annie's eyeballs rolling in their sockets. "No, but nothing much has happened in between, has it? Unless you've come round here to finish with me, in which case you're not even sleeping on the sofa. You're out," Gina laughed. So Duncan laughed too. No, but... Good, that settles it. It's just that..." Gina put her arms round his neck and kissed him on the lips. "You smell beery." I was drinking lager when..." He was trying to remember if he'd ever even mentioned Annie. He'd certainly been conscious of saying "we, I" a lot in the 2 or 3 conversations he'd had with Gina, as in, "we, I can never stop after one episode of The Wire," or "we, I went on a little tour of the US in the summer." Although Gina had never shown any curiosity in the derivation of this particular new pronoun. And then, when he'd trained himself to exclude the existence of Annie, he'd had to reintroduce her anonymously because he felt it was beginning to sound as though he'd spent the previous 15 years going to the cinema and listening to music on his own. So he'd said things like, "Yes, I saw that, with the woman I was, you know, seeing at the time. I've had a rather difficult evening, actually." "I'm sorry." "Yes, I can't remember if I've ever mentioned... Anyway, I had something to sort out tonight. Because of you." "Do you mean romantically?" He was tempted to qualify Gina's adverb and explain that he wasn't really involved with Annie romantically, that it was more a question of jigsaw pieces, but he could see that that might not have been terribly helpful. "I suppose so, yes." "A long-term thing?" Duncan paused. He knew the answer to this question, really. 15 years was a long-term thing, unambiguously. So it would be disingenuous to say something like, "what do you mean?" or "define your terms." "What counts as a long-term thing for you? A year?" He made a face that suggested mute calculation. He was more or less counting on his fingers in his head. "Yes." "Oh. Oh, dear. And was it bloody?" "It was a bit, yes." "Is that why you raised the subject of the sofa?" "I suppose it might have been, yes." "And are you with her now?" "No." "Okay." And that was all there was to say about his previous relationship, as far as Gina was concerned. Duncan felt homesick the entire night and slept poorly. Gina, however, seemed inappropriately cheerful about everything. Duncan was forced to conclude that she just didn't get the magnitude of his breakup with Annie, possibly because she was shallow and lacking in empathy. Only later did he realize that she was unlikely to get the magnitude of it because he'd willfully and possibly even deceitfully shrunk it. He'd knocked 14 years off it and then asked her to acknowledge that she was a homewrecker. He told her it was just a scratch and got cross when she hadn't offered morphine. Returning home didn't help with his homesickness, inevitably. It simply made it worse. He wanted to linger, maybe even watch a DVD and pretend that it was a normal Saturday morning, but he doubted whether that would help him much. He finished packing his bag, enough for a week or so, no more, and left. Duncan didn't know too much about the vicissitudes of Tucker Crowe's love life. Nobody did, really, although there had been much speculation on the web. But he imagined it to have been tumultuous. How did he stand it? How many times had Tucker had to pack his bag like this, say goodbye to a home? Not for the first time, Duncan wished that he knew Tucker personally. He would very much like to ask him what he took with him when he moved out of one life and into another. Was underwear the key? For some reason, he imagined Tucker would have a tip for him, something like, "Don't worry about T-shirts," or "Never leave your favorite picture behind." Duncan's favorite picture was an original Dr. No poster that he and Annie had found, incredibly, in a junk shop in Goulinas. He was pretty sure he was the one who'd paid for it, so he'd be entitled to remove it. On the other hand, it was quite big and covered a large damp patch on the bedroom wall. If he left the damp patch exposed, there'd be trouble. He settled for his second favorite, an 18x12 shot of Tucker he'd bought on eBay. It was taken in the late 70s, perhaps at the bottom line in New York, and Crow looked good, young and confident and happy. He'd had it framed, but Annie never wanted it up in the sitting room or the bedroom, so it was propped up against the wall in the office. She wouldn't mind that he'd taken it. Indeed, she'd probably mind if he didn't. And it seemed appropriate, seeing as it was Tucker's advice in the first place. Imaginary advice, anyway. It was somewhat embarrassing, perhaps, walking into Gina's flat with a small duffel bag and a large picture. But Gina loved it. Or said she did. Gina was enthusiastic about a lot of things. He spent the weekend almost entirely in Gina's company. They ate good food, watched two movies, went for a walk along the beach, had sex twice, on Saturday night and Sunday night. And everything felt wrong, off, peculiar. Duncan couldn't shake the feeling that he was living somebody else's life. A life that was much more enjoyable than his own had been recently, but which didn't suit him, or fit him, or something. And then on Monday morning, they cycled into work together, and when it was time for the first classes of the day, Gina kissed him goodbye, on the lips, and squeezed his bottom playfully while colleagues watched, stupefied with excitement. By lunchtime, everybody in the college knew that they were a couple.
Chapter 8. What to say? Tucker couldn't think of anything, or rather, he couldn't think of anything that would help in any way. "Let's give it one more try. I'm pretty sure I can change. Would you like to go to counseling?" His previous and extensive history of messing up relationships was useful only up to a point. Effectively, all it did was make him give in to the inevitable much more quickly. He was like a mechanic who could take one look at an old car and tell its owner, "Well, yes, I could try. But the truth of it is, you'll be back here again in 2 months, and you'll have spent an awful lot of money in the meantime." He'd attempted to change before. He'd been to marriage counseling, he'd given it another try, and all of this had merely served to attenuate the agony. Experience, then, was something that enabled you to do nothing with a clear conscience. Experience was an overrated quality. It was news to him that Cat had been kind of seeing somebody, if only in a, quote, pretty much semi-platonic way. He was tempted in a spirit of devilment to press for a definition of semi-platonic, but he was afraid that Cat might actually try to provide one, and neither of them could cope with the ensuing embarrassment. Try as he might, however, he couldn't see it as front-page news, or even a headline in the sports section. She was a young woman, and as a consequence didn't subscribe to the idea that monogamous sexual relationships between men and women were doomed, pointless, miserable, hopeless. She'd get there, he felt, but not for a while yet. Of course she was seeing somebody. Tucker wondered whether he knew the man who was being kind of seen, and then wondered whether to ask if he knew him. In the end, he decided against it. He could see what would happen. Cat would tell him that, yes, Tucker had met him before, and Tucker would have to confess that he couldn't bring him to mind. Unless Cat was kind of seeing a friend of his, the name she provided was unlikely to mean much. Cat was staring at him. He was stirring his coffee and had been for the last few minutes. Had she asked him a question? He rewound until he heard her voice. I think we've reached the end of the road, is what she'd said. Which wasn't actually a question, although it clearly required an acknowledgement of receipt, at least. I'm sorry, sweetheart, but I think you're probably right. And that's all you have to say? I think so. Jackson walked into the room, saw Tucker and Cat sitting there expectantly, and ran out again. I told you, said Tucker. He tried to keep it to that, but he was actually really angry. Jackson was a smart kid, and it had taken him 3 seconds to sense the danger in that room. The silence, his parents' obvious nervousness. Go get him, said Cat. You go get him. This was all your idea. And then when he could see Cat was going to react, telling him was your idea, I mean, telling him like this, formally. Tucker wasn't sure how they should have done it, but he knew they'd got it wrong. Why had Cat decided that the den was the right place? None of them ever used it. It was dark and smelled musty. They might just as well have woken him up in the middle of the night and yelled something weird and upsetting is going to happen at him through a megaphone. And the formation, Cat and Tucker side by side on a sofa, never happened much in real life either. They were a head-on couple. You know I can't, Cat said. He won't come unless you do it. And this, of course, was a neat illustration of the trouble she faced. Shortly, not today, not here and now, but sometime soon, Jackson would be forced to choose which parent he was going to live with. And really, that was no choice at all. Cat, like your average American dad, hadn't seen much of Jackson since the first 6 months of his life. She'd been too busy keeping food on the table. Cat knew she wouldn't be eating breakfast with her son much in the near future, which made her determination to end the relationship even more impressive, Tucker thought. And his security, the reassuring knowledge that the apparently unavoidable split couldn't come between him and his son, probably sucked a great deal of the desperation out of his efforts to smooth things over. He and Jackson were the couple, and they didn't need a lawyer. Jackson was in his room bashing the hell out of buttons on a cheap computer game. He didn't look up when Tucker opened the door. You want to come back downstairs?
No.
It'll be easier if the three of us talk.
I know what you want to talk about.
What?
Mommy and Daddy are having problems, so we're going to split up from each other, but it doesn't mean we don't love you, blah, blah, blah. There, now I don't have to go.
Jesus, thought Tucker. 6 years old and already these kids can parody the language of marital failure. Where did you get all that from?
Like 500 TV shows plus 500 kids at school, so that's 1,000, right?
Right, 500 plus 500 makes 1,000.
Jackson couldn't prevent a tiny flicker of triumph from crossing his face.
Okay, you don't have to come down, but please be kind to your mother.
She knows I want to live with you, right?
Yeah, she knows, and she's upset about it.
Dad, do we have to move to another house?
I don't know. Not if you don't want to.
Really?
Sure.
So it doesn't matter that you don't have any money?
No, not at all. Tucker was pleased with the dismissive tone. It suggested that only a kid with no knowledge of the way the world worked would even have brought the subject up.
Cool. Tucker went back downstairs to explain to his wife that she'd have to give up both her child and her house. Tucker now accepted, without question, that he couldn't make a marriage or anything resembling a marriage work. He had never been absolutely sure whether he was married to Kat or not. Kat referred to him as her husband, and it always sounded a little off to him, but he'd never been able to ask her directly whether there was any legal basis for her description of his status. She'd be hurt that he couldn't remember. Certainly there'd been no ceremony since sobriety, but anything could have happened before that. He was one of those people whose flaws remained consistent whoever he was with. He'd had friends who'd had good second marriages, and they always talked about the relief they'd felt when they realized that the first had gone wrong because of the dynamic, rather than any inherent failing in themselves. But, as several women, women who didn't resemble one another in any way, had all complained of the same things, he had to accept that dynamics had nothing to do with anything. It was all him. At the beginning, something, infatuation, hope, whatever, helped disguise his real shape. But then the tide went out, and all was revealed, and it was ugly, dark, and jagged, and unpleasant. One of the chief complaints was that he never did anything, which Tucker couldn't help but feel was unfair. Not because the complaint was groundless, because it obviously wasn't, but because, in certain circles, Tucker was one of the most famous do-nothings in the United States. All of these women had known that he hadn't done anything since 1986. That, it seemed to him, was his unique selling point. And it was a never-ending source of fascination. But when he'd continued to do nothing, there was outrage. Where was the justice in that? He could see that several of these women, Kat included, had presumed, without ever articulating it or possibly even acknowledging it to themselves, that they'd be able to redeem him, bring him back to life. They'd appointed themselves muses, and he would respond to their love, inspiration, and care by making the most beautiful and passionate music of his career. And then, when nothing happened, they were left with an ex-musician who sat around the house drinking, watching game shows and reading Victorian novels in his sweatpants, and they didn't like it much. Who could blame them? There wasn't much to like. With Kat, it had been different because he'd sobered up and taken care of Jackson. But he was still a disappointment to her. He was a disappointment to himself, but that didn't help anyone much. It wasn't as if he was a happy slacker, either. He'd never been able to shrug away the loss of his talent, for want of a better word to describe whatever the hell it was he once had. Sure, he'd got used to the idea that there wouldn't be a new album or even a new song anytime soon, but he'd never learned to look on his inability to write as anything other than a temporary state, which meant that he was permanently unsettled, as if he were in an airport lounge waiting for a plane. In the old days, when he flew a lot, he'd never been able to get absorbed in a book until the plane had taken off. So he'd spent the pre-boarding time flicking through magazines and browsing in gift shops. And that's what the last couple of decades had felt like. One long flick through a magazine. If he'd known how long he was going to spend in the airport lounge of his own life, he'd have made different travel arrangements. But instead, he'd sat there, sighing and fidgeting, and more often than was really acceptable, snapping at his traveling companions. "What are you going to do?" they asked. All the cats and gnats and other wives and lovers and mothers of his children whose names sometimes blurred regrettably together. And he always told them what he thought they should want to hear. "I'm going to look for a job," he said, or, "I'm retraining as an accountant." And they'd sigh and roll their eyes, which for him merely underlined the impossibility of his situation. How else to answer other than to say, he was going to look for a job, do something else, stop being a former something. A few months back, he'd called Kat on the eye-rolling, asked her for some suggestions. After some deliberation, she announced that she thought he should be a singer-songwriter, but one who actually sang and wrote songs. She hadn't articulated the idea exactly in those terms, of course, but that was pretty much what it amounted to.
He'd laughed a lot. She'd gotten angry. One more finger had been prized off the rope they were clinging to. Up until a couple of years ago, Tucker's best and only friend in the neighborhood had been known as Farmer John, after the old Premier's song, because his name was John, and he lived on a farm. Then something strange happened, and one of the eventual consequences was that Farmer John became known affectionately to his nearest and dearest as Fucker. This select group included, to Cat's mortification and Tucker's childish delight, Jackson. The strange thing that happened was this. Sometime in 2003, one of the half-crazed fans who refer to themselves as crowologists drove up the dirt track that led to Farmer John's farm, apparently in the belief that Tucker lived there. While John was walking down to the stranger's car to talk to him, the driver's door opened, the fan emerged, and he started frantically taking pictures of John with a fancy-looking camera. Tucker had never really learned how John earned a living. He was no farmer, that was for sure. And every time anyone asked him, he was impressively, and sometimes even aggressively, evasive. The general presumption was that there was some harmless, low-level illegal activity involved somewhere, which was probably why John went for the photographer, who kept snapping pictures even as he got into the car to make his escape. Within days, the scariest of these photos, and John, a grizzled man with long, matted gray hair, never looked anything less than intimidating anyway, was being passed from website to website. Neil Ritchie, the photographer, became almost famous, the man who'd stolen the first shot of Tucker Crowe in over 15 years. It was still, even now, the first image you saw if you went to find a picture of Tucker on the internet. At first, Tucker was baffled by the easy passage the photo had through cyberspace. Nobody ever asked how a man who looked like that in 1986 could look like this in 2003. Hair can grow long and get dirty and go gray, sure, but could noses change shape that easily? Could eyes start creeping closer together? Could mouths get wider, lips thinner? But then, the photo was never used anywhere that it was likely to get fact-checked. Tucker had long since drifted away from the mainstream media and into the backwaters where all the screwballs and conspiracy theorists did their fishing. And anyway, to talk about plausibility was to miss the point. The few people who hadn't forgotten him, people who had turned his songs into hymns that contained profoundly helpful guidance on just about everything, wanted him to look like Farmer John. Tucker was a genius, according to these people, and he'd gone mad, and that's what mad geniuses look like. And John's anger was perfect, too. Neil Ritchie almost certainly had other shots of John ambling toward his car, but they just didn't fit with the idea of someone who was clearly so obsessive about his privacy. The moment John went nuts was the moment he turned into Tucker Crowe, damaged recluse. Tucker, meanwhile, the real one, the one who drove Jackson to Little League games, kept his silver hair neatly trimmed, wore moderately fashionable rimless spectacles, and shaved every day. He felt like Fucker on the inside, which is why he'd always made sure he looked like somebody you'd be happy to buy insurance from. Anyway, Farmer John became known to Tucker and Cat and Jackson and a few other friends and neighbors as Fake Tucker. And Fake Tucker became, inevitably, Fucker. And when Tucker needed to get out of the house and out into the world, it was Fucker he took with him. Not because the confusion was helpful in any way, but because he didn't really know any other men anymore. It was always slightly complicated, though, a night out with the Fuck. Tucker couldn't drink, and Fucker couldn't not drink. And though Tucker could watch someone sipping liquor slowly and in moderation, it didn't do him much good to watch somebody get slammed. So the deal was this. Fucker had to be given an hour's notice, and in that hour, he'd work his way through several fingers of Bushmills and get a glow on. By the time Tucker came to pick him up, he'd only need a small top-up, and occasionally he'd be ready for a mug of coffee. Fucker wanted to listen to a band that was playing in a local bar.
Why? Because it might be fun.
Oh, man, said Tucker. Do we have to? You don't drink, you don't listen to music. Why do you even ask me to go out at night? How about this? You want to see me? We'll meet for breakfast. Except you probably disapprove of eggs, or you used to snort them back in the 80s, so you can't be in the same room as them now.
I need to talk, I think.
Why, you screwed it all up with Kat?
Yep.
Wow, who could have seen that coming?
Tucker actually valued John's blunt sarcasm. It felt bracing, like one of those sponges cat-like that were supposed to remove dead skin.
Yeah, maybe you're right. Maybe we should go see a band. That way I don't have to listen to you. Well, I've said all I have to say, apart from you're an idiot. How's Jackson?
He's okay. He's not amazed either, really. He just wanted to make sure that he could be with me and stay in the house.
And is that possible?
Apparently. Kat's going to look for an apartment in town, somewhere Jackson can sleep when he wants to.
So you stole Kat's house from her?
For now.
What's going to change?
Either I start earning some money or Jackson turns 18 and goes to college.
You taking bets on what happens first?
Maybe Juliet Naked will make me some money.
Oh, yeah, I forgot you had a new album out. There must be a million people who want to hear crappy versions of songs they forgot about years ago.
Tucker laughed. John had never heard his work before he moved into the neighborhood, but one night, drunk, he'd told Tucker that he'd played Juliet incessantly when he'd split with his wife. He'd been dismissive of Naked for pretty much the same reasons as that English girl, although he was less eloquent in his expression of them. It had been a long time since Tucker had been anywhere to hear a band, and he couldn't quite believe how familiar it all felt. Shouldn't something have moved on by now? Did you really still have to lug all your equipment in by yourself, sell your records and t-shirts at the back of the room, talk to the crazy guy with no friends who'd been to see you 3 times this week already? There wasn't much anybody could do with the live music experience, though. It was what it was. Bars and the bands that played in them didn't have much use for the shiny white apple world out there. There'd be processed cheese slices for dinner and blocked toilets until the world melted away. Tucker went to the bar and got their drinks, a Coke for himself and a glass of Jameson for Fucker, and they sat down at a table at the side of the room, away from the tiny low stage and the lights.
"But you're doing okay?" said Fucker.
"Yeah.
Wondering whether you'll ever have sex again?"
"Not yet."
"You should."
"If you can find someone to sleep with, anyone can." Fucker was seeing a divorced English teacher from the local high school.
"You don't have my charm, though."
"Lizette probably thought you were me, anyway."
"You know what? That picture has never done me the smallest bit of good with a woman. Think about that, my friend."
"I have. And the conclusion I've drawn is it's a picture of you, not me, and it makes you look like a bug-eyed psycho." The house lights went down, and the band ambled out onto the stage to the general indifference of the drinkers in the room. They weren't young men, the musicians, and Tucker wondered how often they'd been tempted to quit, and why they hadn't done so. Maybe it was because they hadn't been able to think of anything better to do. Maybe it was even because they thought this was fun.
They were okay.
Their own songs weren't anything special, but they knew that, because they played Hickory Wind and Highway 61 and Sweet Home Alabama. They knew their audience anyway. Tucker and John were surrounded by gray ponytails and bald heads. Tucker looked around to see if he could spot anybody under 40 and saw a young man who immediately looked away when Tucker caught his eye.
"Uh-oh," said Tucker. "What's up?"
"That kid over there by the men's room, I think he's recognized you."
"Cool, that never happens anymore. Shall we have some fun?"
"What do you call fun?"
"I'll think of something."
But then it got too loud to talk much, and Tucker started to get gloomy. He had feared the onset of gloom. It was the real reason he hadn't wanted to come out in the first place. He'd spent a lot of time doing nothing, but the trick to doing nothing, as far as he was concerned, anyway, was not to think while you were doing it. The trouble with going to see bands is that there wasn't much else to do but think if you weren't being swept away on a wave of visceral or intellectual excitement. And Tucker could tell that the Chris Jones Band would never be able to make people forget who they were and how they'd ended up that way despite their sweaty endeavors. Mediocre, loud music penned you into yourself, made you pace up and down your own mind until you were pretty sure you could see how you might end up going out of it. In the 75 minutes that he spent with himself, he managed to revisit pretty much every single place that he'd have been happy never to see again. He worked back from Cat and Jackson to all the other screwed-up marriages and kids. The professional wasteland of the last 20 years ran alongside them, like a rusted-over railroad running alongside a traffic jam. People underestimated the speed of thought. It was possible to cover just about every major incident of a lifetime during the average bar band set. When the band waved to the handful of people applauding them and walked off stage, John disappeared through the door at the side of the stage to find them. A couple of minutes later, he was leading the musicians back for their encore. "As some of you know, it's been a long time since I've done this," said John into the microphone. A couple of people in the bar laughed, either because they knew the story or because they'd heard him sing before. Tucker watched the kid who'd been staring at them earlier. He was already on his feet and making his way to the foot of the stage. He looked as though he might faint with excitement. John grabbed the mic stand, nodded at the band, and they did their best Crazy Horse impersonation for a ragged but recognizable Farmer John. Fucker sounded terrible, too loud, off-key, and insane, but it clearly didn't matter to his one fan, who was leaping up and down with excitement while taking as many shots as he could with the camera on his cell phone. John finished with an ungainly leap into the air several seconds after the musician's last chord and grinned happily at Tucker. The kid stopped John while he was making his way back to the seat, and John spoke to him for a couple of minutes. "What did you say?"
"Oh, just a bunch of made-up crap, but it doesn't matter. Tucker Crow spoke."
When Tucker got home that night, everyone was asleep. So he sat down and wrote to English Annie. She was English Annie because she wasn't the Annie with whom he'd been conducting a chaste but, nonetheless, morale-boosting flirtation for a while now. American Annie was the mother of Jackson's school friend Toby. She was in her mid-30s, recently divorced, lonely, and pretty. He'd started to think about her within hours, okay, minutes, of Cat telling him that they'd reached the end of the road. Tellingly, however, the thought of Toby's Annie hadn't cheered him much. He'd only been able to see a whole lot of grim, consequential inevitabilities. Ill-advised sex, his inability to follow through, hurt and the destruction of one of Jackson's most important relationships. Well, fuck that. Maybe he should concentrate on flirting with someone who lived on another continent. A woman who only lived in cyberspace and didn't have a son on Jackson's Little League team, or indeed, any kind of son, which was one of the reasons she'd been so attractively expansive in the first place. Anyway, English Annie had been on his mind in the bar. A couple of the questions she'd asked in her last email were similar to the questions he'd ended up asking himself during his sonic incarceration earlier in the evening, and it seemed like it might be more helpful to think about them as part of a conversation with someone. "Dear Annie, here's another way of proving I am who I claim to be. Have you ever seen that picture someone took of a scared, crazy person a few years back? You say you know people who still like my music. Well, they're the kind of people who are familiar with the photo because they are under the impression that it's me. They think it's a revealing, if unflattering, portrait of a creative genius having some kind of breakdown, but it's not. It's a fair likeness of my neighbor John, who is a nice guy but not a creative genius as far as I know. And he wasn't having a breakdown. He was just flipping out. John went nuts because, not unreasonably, he didn't like this guy snapping away at him, possibly because he's got a whole field of cannabis plants in his backyard. I have no idea whether he has or hasn't. I just know he's touchy about trespassers.
Tucker stopped and opened the photo library. He'd attached a picture to an email a couple of times, and he was pretty sure he could do it again. He found one of him and Jackson outside Citizens Bank Park earlier on in the summer and clicked the paperclip icon, hopefully. It seemed to work. But would she think he was hitting on her? Could sending a photo of himself with his cute son, no woman in sight, be construed as some kind of come-on? He removed the attachment just in case. Anyway, it's a good story, right? Around here, John has been christened Fucker, derived from fake Tucker, if you'll pardon my language, and forgive the yoking together a word alluding to our Lord with an obscenity. And tonight, Fucker sang with a local bar band, thus overexciting a kid in the audience who clearly thought he was witnessing my resurrection. If anyone tells you I'm making a comeback, you can tell them it was Farmer John. Which is what he sang. You know that song? I'm in love with your daughter, whoa, whoa. No, the photo made sense of the email. How else could he prove that he didn't look like John? And he wasn't trying to prove that he was better looking than John. He was trying to show that he and John didn't resemble each other, and the whole wild man of the woods thing was a hilarious internet myth. He reattached the attachment. This is me, outside a baseball stadium with my youngest son, Jackson. I've always kept my hair short since I gave up music, probably because I was afraid people might think I'd turned into someone like John. Plus, I wear glasses, which I didn't used to. I've spent a lot of time reading the small print of big novels, and... Big novels? Why did he feel the need to tell English Annie why he needed to wear glasses? So she didn't think it was because he did too much jerking off? He deleted the last line. It was none of her business. Plus, that pardon my language thing sounded prissy. If she couldn't cope with bad language, then fuck her. And that phrase begged a few questions. What did he want English Annie to look like? If he knew for sure that she weighed 200 pounds, would he be pursuing this correspondence? Maybe he should ask her for a reciprocal photo, except then he would really look like some kind of creepy stalker. And anyway, what was he supposed to do with this girl? Invite her to come over? But actually, now that he thought about it... I'll probably be coming to England sometime in the next few months to see my grandchild. How far is your museum from London, where my daughter lives? I'd like to see your dead shark pictures. Or do you ever go down south? I don't really know anybody in England, so... So what? He scrapped the last half sentence, and then the one before it, too. It was okay to tell someone you wanted to see their dead shark pictures, wasn't it? Or did that have a sleazy ring to it, too? And hold on, do you ever go down south? Jesus Christ. There was a reason he'd given up talking to people he didn't know.
Chapter 9. The extraordinary news that Tucker had made some kind of bizarre public appearance passed Duncan by for a couple of days. There was so much going on in his personal life that he hadn't had time to check the website, an oversight which, he later realized, neatly proved one of Annie's cruel theories about crowologists. "I know get a life is a cliché," she used to say, "but really, if these people actually had anything to do all day, they wouldn't have time to write his lyrics out backward to see if there were any hidden messages in them." Only one person on the message boards had ever done that, and he did nothing all day because, it was eventually discovered, he was writing from the psychiatric ward of a hospital. But Duncan could see her point. The moment Duncan had found something to do, namely trying to grab the steering wheel back from the maniac who seemed to be driving his life, then Tucker had been forgotten. One evening, when Gina had gone to bed early, Duncan sat down at her computer and rejoined his little community. Mostly because he wanted to feel normal for a few minutes, to do something that he used to do. Looking at a picture of Tucker taken a few nights before, on stage with a band Duncan had never heard of, really didn't help with his attempted reorientation. It actually made him feel rather giddy. It seemed to be genuine. There was no mistaking the man from the infamous Neil Ritchie photo, the same long grey dreadlocks, the same discoloured teeth. Although this time the teeth were visible because Tucker was smiling, rather than because they were being bared in anger. It was incredible that anyone who'd ever heard of Tucker was in the crowd to see it. The band were, as far as it was possible to tell, a distinctly ordinary bunch of pub rockers who played bars all over Pennsylvania, but not much farther than that. It turned out that the young man who got the scoop was in the middle of the same sort of crow pilgrimage that Duncan and Annie had embarked on in the summer. He, however, had set out to try and find Tucker, and it looked as though he'd struck it astonishingly lucky. But why Farmer John? Duncan would have to think about that. A man as deliberate and thoughtful as Crow would be trying to say something with the song that broke a 20-year silence, but what? Duncan certainly had the Neil Young version. He would try to find the original before he went to bed. There was more, however. The witness, who identified himself only by his initials, E.T., had managed to speak to Crow when he came off stage, and Crow had spoken back. "So I thought, well, I have to try, and I went up to him and I said, 'Tucker, I am a big fan, and I am so happy to see you singing again. Dumb, I know, but you try and think of something better.' And then I said, 'Will you be singing your own songs on stage anytime soon?' And he said, 'Yes.' And also, he had a new album coming out. And I said, 'Yes, I know, Naked.' And he said, 'No, not that piece of shit.'" Duncan smiled to himself. The self-deprecation proved, perhaps in a strange way, with even more certainty than the photograph, that this was indeed Tucker. It was an old pattern, exemplified in countless interviews from the old days. Tucker knew that Naked wasn't a piece of shit, but it was entirely typical of him to describe it as such on its release to an overeager fan. Duncan decided he wouldn't pass this part of the story on to Annie, though. She'd misunderstand, come to the conclusion that Tucker was validating her opinion of the album, when in fact he was doing the opposite. "I have a new album coming out, an album of covers of Dean Martin songs, but done kind of roots rock, and I kind of went, wow, and he smiled, and then went to sit with his friend, and I thought, I can't bug him again, so I know the Dean Martin bit sounds weird, but that's what he said. I cannot tell you how amazing it all was. I'm still shaking." It seemed wrong that he couldn't share any of this with Annie. Gina would be excited when he told her in the morning, but then sometimes he wondered whether her excitement was entirely genuine. Occasionally it felt to him as though it were a little theatrical, although maybe he wouldn't have arrived at that word were it not for her background. But then she was a performer, and she performed, even when there didn't seem to be very much motivation for her character. She couldn't possibly understand what Tucker's re-emergence meant. She hadn't put the time in, but she would jump up and down and shout, "Oh my God," anyway. Perhaps it would be better if he didn't tell her, and then he wouldn't end up disliking her for her phoniness. Annie, however, had lived through the entirety of Tucker's disappearance, and she would grasp the emotional impact of the news immediately. Did his relationship with Gina prevent him from sharing things like this with Annie? He thought not. He looked at his watch. She wouldn't be in bed yet unless her habits had changed profoundly since his departure. "Annie? Duncan, what's the matter? I was in bed." "Oh, I'm sorry." He hoped she wasn't going to bed early on his account, but he feared it might be an indication of depression. "Listen, something rather amazing has happened," he said. "I hope it is something amazing, Duncan. I hope that normal people would share your excitement." "They would if they knew what it meant." "It's going to be something to do with Tucker, isn't it?"
"Yes."
She sighed heavily, which he understood as an invitation to continue.
"He sang, live, in a bar. He joined a, well, an apparently rather mediocre band for an encore of Farmer John. You know that song? Farmer John, I'm in love with your daughter, woo-woo." And then he told someone in the audience he was making an album of Dean Martin cover versions.
"Right. Good-o. Can I go to bed yet?"
"Annie, you're cutting off your nose to spite your face."
"I'm sorry?"
"I know you can see how amazing this is, and you're just pretending it's boring because you think you can get back at me, but I'd hoped you'd be above all that."
"I am excited, Duncan, honestly. If we were on video phone now, you'd see I was beside myself, but it's also late and I'm tired."
"If you want to be like that."
"I do, really."
"So you don't really see us being able to build some kind of friendship?"
"Not tonight, no."
"I suppose... stop me if you feel this analogy is inappropriate or off, but I do feel Tucker is our child in a way, maybe more mine than yours, maybe. I don't know. He was my son, but he was very young when we met, and you adopted him. And if my son, your stepson, had done something remarkable, I'd want to share that with you, even if... Annie hung up on him. He ended up writing an email to Ed West from the website, but it wasn't the same. For the next few days, the message board regulars shared everything they knew about the song in the hope that they could decode Crow's message to the world. They discussed whether the champagne eyes of the farmer's daughter were significant. Was Tucker acknowledging the role alcohol had played and maybe was continuing to play in his life? Even with all the critical ingenuity they had at their disposal, there wasn't much they could make of the rest of the lyrics, which were of the I love the way she walks, talks, wiggles variety. Could it be that he was simply announcing his love for a farmer's daughter? There were probably several in his immediate vicinity, so why couldn't he have fallen in love with one of them? And of course it was impossible to imagine a farmer's daughter without imagining a pair of apple-rosy cheeks and perhaps a becoming heft around the waist and the bottom. Compare and contrast with the pale, size-zero beauty of Julie Beatty in her ilk. If he was truly in love with a farmer's daughter, then the old, unhealthy West Coast days were really over. There was much talk of the Neil Young connection, Young being a musician Crow had always admired, and an artist who had managed to grow old creatively and productively. Was it an expression of regret for all the time wasted? Or was he saying that Young had taught him a way forward? The song's inclusion on Lenny Kaye's influential 1972 Nuggets compilation, alongside the likes of the Standells and the Strawberry Alarm Clock, provoked comment too, although nobody could make anything really coherent out of the connection. The real point was that for the second time in a few days, they had been given something to debate, naked and now this. It really did feel as though Tucker's hibernation might be drawing to a close.
Annie printed the picture of Tucker and Jackson at work, took it home, and stuck it onto the fridge with the Sun Studios fridge magnet that she supposed Duncan would one day reclaim if he were ever again in a position to think about the smaller details of a home life. It was a lovely picture, anyway. Jackson was a beautiful child, and Tucker's pride in him was obvious and touching. But Jackson and Tucker weren't up on her fridge simply because they looked happy. She knew that much. And whenever they caught her eye, she ended up thinking about what they did for her, and whether it was all terribly unhealthy. There was definitely a sad sack fantasy element to it, she couldn't deny that. Tucker had mentioned in his email that he was single again, so she didn't need to spell it out. She wanted to be honest with herself, but honesty didn't mean having to complete every sentence, not when the missing subordinate clause suggested so much emptiness. Anyway, there was another less embarrassing explanation for the cheering effect of the picture. Her relationship with Tucker, even as it stood, even excluding the schoolgirl dreams about Tucker coming to London, and maybe even to Gulliness, and maybe even staying with her, and maybe even not staying on the couch, was exciting. How could it not be? She had something that nobody else in the world had, as far as she knew. Email conversation with the sort of famous Tucker Crowe, an enigmatic, talented, intelligent man who disappeared a long time ago. That would brighten anybody's day, surely. But then there were the darker, Duncan-related pleasures she was discovering in this situation. It had taken her about a minute and a half to work out that if Duncan ever looked at the fridge, he would have no idea who he was staring at, and the ironies of that were good enough and large enough to eat with a knife and fork on their own with no accompanying bitterness. She could tell him anything, and he'd believe her, because he knew for a fact that Tucker Crowe now looked like Rasputin, or maybe Merlin. Annie had checked Duncan's website when Tucker told her about Fucker's unscheduled appearance in the bar, and his picture was there, as Tucker had told her it would be. And she noticed with great delight that Fucker had described Naked as a piece of shit. What would Duncan have made of that? Really, it was all too much. Her real relationship with Tucker would be enough to drive him into a frenzy of jealousy if he ever found out about it. Although she wasn't entirely sure who he'd be jealous of. But even her pretend relationship with the man on the fridge might be enough to provoke a few twinges. First, though, She needed Duncan to visit, and she needed him to take notice of something that he would never normally spot in 100 years. A very small change to a domestic environment. Maybe if she blew the picture up so that it covered the entirety of a wall, he might ask her whether she'd done something to the kitchen.